Hi everyone, and thank you for joining us on another episode of Lid Publishing's podcast, Lid Radio. My name is Mirai, and I will be your host for today. With me today is a very special guest. It is Michael Veltri. How are you today, Michael?
Doing great, Mira. Thanks for the opportunity to have me on.
Absolutely, it's my pleasure. And for those listening, Michael is a top-rated keynote speaker, serial entrepreneur, and leadership expert for elite organizations such as the Central Intelligence Agency and many Fortune 500 companies. As a professional athlete, two-time cancer survivor, and U.S. Marine veteran, Michael shares his unique message of business transformation and peak performance to leaders, executive, entrepreneurs, and professionals worldwide. He is joining us today to talk about his new book, The Mushin Way to Peak Performance, and also his work. So once again, thank you very much for joining us, Michael.
And
I would like to get into the first question, and that's the one I ask every author that comes on the podcast, and that is, what inspired you to become an author in the first place?
Yeah, Mira, thanks. There's two things that inspired me. One was becoming an author allowed me to get my message out to a much broader audience. And like, for example, you and I are sitting across the pond here talking, and I'm able to share my message of peak performance. And it's peak performance, Mira, for high achievers with balance, not burnout, using these really elegant principles of the martial arts. So by becoming an author, it allows me to reach a wider audience. And the second thing is, as a keynote speaker, being able to leave the book behind for my audience helps them to retain my message. So the last thing I want to do as a keynote speaker is, you know, have a great 60-minute or 90-minute presentation and then have people be like, that's awesome. I can't wait to apply your principles, Michael. And then they get a lot of traction and they don't have anything to follow up with. So the book is a way to help people follow up after they've heard me speak and implement my tools and techniques.
Right. And actually talking about the book itself, the first thing that really stuck out for me was the title itself, and in particular the word Mushin, which translates quite directly into empty mind in English from Japanese, and is a mental state within martial arts. Can you give us some insight on why you chose the title and its relevance to the content?
Sure. So I'll be honest, right? Like anything, it was a little scary. I was hesitant to use jargon, Miro, like, you know, using a Japanese word in the title as it might confuse people. But, you know, my team and I said, listen, hopefully it's gonna raise interest. So you're absolutely right. The literal translation is empty mind or no mind, but I like to think of it as no distractions with the mind, or another way of even saying it more precise is clarity. So for me, a better translation for the word Mushin is clarity. And that's what the book talks about. It's about if we can become much more clear in our lives, have clarity, it helps us in our decision-making process, Miro. Whether it's the little itty-bitty decisions or those great big, oh my goodness, decisions. And if we're able to have that clarity, to be able to make better decisions, then that leads to my whole concept around peak performance with balance, not burnout. Because, you know, we're all good about pushing ourselves and then burning out and being miserable, or what I call successfully miserable. So practicing this concept of Mushin allows you to cut through the clutter of worry, of fear, of ego, and get to the heart of the matter where people can still be successful, still have a level of peak performance, and, you know, get back to their clients on their email and, you know, in the middle of the workday and everything, but without becoming successfully miserable.
And in the book, you talk about your deep history within martial arts, and especially the Japanese martial art of Aikido. Tell us a bit about how this whole story started and what impact it has had on you in business.
Yes. So the martial arts have always been a very deep and personal part of my life. One of the things I love about the elegant art of Aikido is it's a form, it's not self-offense, Muto, right? It's not like you're learning how to pummel somebody or beat them up into a pulp, or the bigger person wins. You know, it really does show how the average person, and let's face it, you know, we're a lot more average than we are, the super rock stars of the world. So it shows how the underdog can win. It shows how a smaller person can legitimately control a bigger, stronger, faster person. And as I was training in this martial art, I lived in Japan for 10 years, I was working in Japan, I started to see how these elegant principles of the martial art can be applied to my business and personal life. And I tell people, the martial art of Aikido literally saved my life, Muto. And it wasn't that I needed to use it in a self-defense situation, but I needed to apply those principles to save my life from the success trap that I had built for myself around it, being an entrepreneur, being a successful person at working for a Fortune 500 company. And thank God for those principles. Otherwise, you know, I wouldn't be talking to you. I'd be miserable and like a lot of people are, not thinking that they don't have a choice to leave their job or start a new business or succeed where they don't think they can succeed.
Right. And in the book, you actually offer readers a very comprehensive list of practical exercises they can use to better themselves and sort of get rid of the improductive situation and habits they might find themselves at work and be really caught up in. Can you perhaps share with us your favorite exercise and why is that?
Yeah, well, you're right. Like I structured the book so with two types of exercises. You know, there's like the little Mushin Wei peak performance tips that pop up throughout the chapter. Try this, try that. Little things that people can immediately implement into their personal and professional life to help get them traction, clarity, win this losing battle against distractions that we're all faced with and reach a level of peak performance. Then each chapter starts and finishes with a more in-depth exercise that allows them to apply the principle that I'm talking about in the chapter. And believe it or not, for me, one of my favorite ones that I don't think a lot of people are even aware of is at the end of the book, chapter 10, where it's a chapter on harmony, where it talks about the very importance of creating what I call the third place. And what I mean by the third place, Mito, is that after work and home, that's where we spend most of our time, our work and home, where is that very vital third place that we need to have in our lives to learn a new skill, to de-stress, to work out, to create other personal and professional opportunities for us? For some people, it might be going to the opera. For some people, it might be going to the gym and working out, or it might be getting involved with their church activities or things like that. But in my experience, successful business people are so focused on place number one, which is, for most people, it's their job, then place number two, going home and sleeping, that they disregard having and setting up and establishing in a very important third place. Or they may have a third place, Mito, but it's not sufficient for them to continue to grow and develop, reduce stress, and like that in their lives. And for some people, you know, the third place might be, you know, hanging out at their buddy's flat just to, you know, watch a sports event or something like that. But in it, I really encourage people to, you know, list what they're to pause and think, okay, where is my third place? Do I even have one? If I have a third place, is it sufficient? You know, am I able to learn a new skill? Am I able to, you know, detox from the day's stressful environment? Am I able to continue to take care of my health and well-being so I can have all of the energy to be successful in my personal and professional life?
Now, before we move forward, I would like to give a bit of context to our audience because the next question I think requires a bit of a sort of grand understanding, especially for the concept of Aikido as a martial art, but beyond that. And you talk about this within the book itself as your introduction, and then it's actually the story of Ueshiba Morihei-san, who was the founder of Aikido. And his absolutely amazing story of quite literally being able to dodge a bullet. Right. But by finding his balance, his inner peace, and using that to his advantage in something which people only think exists in the Matrix. And I think that is absolutely astonishing, and it feeds into my next question, and that is this concept of ki, our life energy. And you have a whole chapter about this in the book.
Yes.
And that sounds almost supernatural, but it does exist. And my question to you is, what was your experience of it, and how did you even manage to harness such a thing?
Sure. And this is a great question, you know, and I'm really glad that you've asked it, you know, and that you understand these concepts so we can have an intelligent conversation about it. So it is right in the book, right? It's nothing mystical. Like, we're not teaching people how to levitate or float.
Right.
The analogy with the Matrix. But the concept of ki, literally translated as energy from the Japanese, is the middle character in the word Aikido. And the word Aikido is made up of three characters. The first character, I, means harmony, ki, energy, and then do means a road or a path. So it's a practice of uniting your energy with those of others around you. Now, the concept of ki, it is an Eastern concept, and it is very difficult for even Japanese or other Asian people to understand the concept. The way I like to describe it for anybody, Miro, is in the military, we talk about command presence, that strong leader standing up there where you could just feel his or her energy. Sometimes it can be, you know, ki can be described as self-confidence. Now, that's not to be confused with arrogance or overconfidence or a false confidence. Sometimes you can be what they call in the groove, right? Like, you're just, everything is just working for you. And what I would tell you and your listeners on the podcast is that it's not that we have to find ki and develop it. What I think happens, Mito, is that we are all within us have this innate ability to harness this energy. And what happens over our years is that we build up layers that prevent us from accessing it. For example, we go off to college and we want to study something, and we end up graduating from college and we end up in a career that we're not quite happy with, and we keep going, or, you know, you're down the road, or you're in an unhappy personal relationship. All of these are layers that are preventing us from accessing that true key energy, where life is easy, where life is effortless, where you wake up in the morning excited for your day because you love what you do, and doing what you do, even if it's only for 30 minutes, gives you unlimited energy. So I think the challenge is, right, is getting people to chisel through those layers. There's a bizarre statistic, Mito, that says, you know, upwards of 70-80% of people, professionals, don't like their job.
Wow.
Right? Like 8 out of 10 people, and that's worldwide. Like, the study was done around the world, and those add layers. And if you're able to chisel through those layers, then you start feeling that energy that, you know, allows you to do superhuman feats, so to say. And again, I don't think it's superhuman. I just think it allows you to be in your vocation, right? You know, not just a job, but something that you truly love to do with people that you love to be with, and serving a cause that you inspires you, whether that's, you know, saving the environment or creating a new technology. That's what I think the challenge is, chiseling through those layers, and then you discover the key, that energy that's always been there.
Right. And we will get into why we will need to be doing that, and how confrontations and distractions can be some of our deterrents to that. But actually, what you said is really interesting to me, because as you were talking, I was thinking, you know, why is this happening, and why do we have so much difficulty in just attaining I will suppose this overarching aura about ourselves. And you know, I mean, I guess it's a bit of an offshoot question, but do you think that perhaps our biggest enemy ends up being ourselves? Simply the fact that if we acknowledge ourselves and we are self-aware, we'll be able to deal with all these issues a lot easier?
Totally. I mean, you are 1,000% correct, you know. I think it's very it's very easy to look for external factors of why we're not as successful or why we're not as happy or in the right relationship or this, that, the other. But it boils down to this self-awareness. And that's, again, where I talk about Mushin, where I talk about clarity. The entire book starts with basically challenging the reader to take a real close look at themselves. You know, I call it like we all have these little dark corners in our mind, you know, where things we don't want to look at that we know we should be looking at.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's our fear and it's our ego. And it's, you know, we might be afraid to look at it, or our ego might say, you know what, I don't have to worry about that. I'll figure it out or whatnot. But you're absolutely right. And once we start chiseling through that fear and ego, and this brings me up in the book. When you ask me about one of my favorite exercises, that discovering a third place, it reminded me of a great quote by Gandhi, where Gandhi says, "A no uttered from the deepest conviction is better than a yes merely uttered to please, or worse, to avoid trouble." And I call that the honorable no. And again, I think many people are afraid of the honorable no. They don't want to tell people no, or they tell people yes for the wrong reasons. And it does boil down to that self-awareness, taking personal responsibility. And again, willpower, grit, and just force will not allow us to get through that, become self-aware. That's why throughout the book, I constantly talk about support structures sufficient for your success. Because again, if left to our own demises, we're not going to look hard at ourselves until, you know, we reach a pain point, you know, where, like I reach, where I told you Aikido saved my life. Well, what I meant by that is I had to become self-aware because I had built an incredibly successful business where I was so burned out after 10 years, you know, I was about to either sell the business or just close the doors and walk away.
Right.
And
right.
That was the pain point where I had to make a big decision. And thank God I was able to make the right decision because of these principles, but it required me to take personal responsibility, become self-aware, and really look hard at a lot of the things I didn't want to look at within myself.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And I think this is sort of a very universal concept. And it goes back to what you said, that with the survey, it was worldwide. You know, it wasn't so much of a cultural issue as it was a self-reflection. And I think it goes back to something I personally read some time ago, where the whole point of the reading was that everyone has a shadow and everyone has a monster within themselves. And the only way to attain virtue and happiness and success is for you to realize that, yes, you do have a monster inside of you, but the way you deal with it is what really matters. You know, you can't escape the way things are, but by assessing those things and then moving forward, you can actually improve yourself. And I think that's a very fascinating concept.
It really is. And we all do. All right, have that little Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde inside us.
Yeah.
You know, hopefully not too sinister. But once we look at him, right, you know, we realize, hey, he's not as bad, or she's not as bad as we thought he was. You know, he's just a scared or lonely little guy, and you know, as long as we take a look at him, it's all right. It's like this too, man. Like, there is no silver bullet. You know, I still deal with my own internal challenges, but I'm aware of it and I keep working on it. And then you always realize, once you look at those dark corners or that little monster, they're never as bad as we think they are, and there's always something you can do. The answer is there somewhere.
Yes.
There's always opportunities within those little quote-unquote problems that we think we have.
Yes, and I would actually like to talk a bit about your experience in terms of the business sense, because you've had the very unique opportunity to work both in the West and the East. And as a lot of people may know, there is a lot of difference when it comes to the corporate world and business in general. So what are the differences in mindset between, let's say, Japan and the West when it comes to business?
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's really boils down to harmony. It really is all about harmony when doing business in Japan. And if you think about it too, Mito, whether it's in the West, people do not buy products and services. People buy people. You know,
right.
I'm not going to do business with a person if I don't trust them. I don't care how good their product or service is. I need to be able to trust that person. In Japan, that is on a preternatural level as far as how valuable personal relationships are. And in the Japanese culture and in many Asian cultures, and this stems from high population centers in Asia, Japan, India, China, Korea, they have very high populations and they don't have a lot of land for the population to live on. So what is developed throughout Asia is this concept in Japanese, it's called honmai and tatemai. And what those words mean is honmai means the showing of your true self, who you are, you know, when you let your hair down around your friends or family, you know, your true essence of Miro, your true essence of Michael. Then you have what's called your tatemai, and that is the front that you put on to show your business colleagues, your work colleagues, that when you're meeting somebody for the first time in a business relationship, you sort of have your armor up a little bit so people can't really see the true person. And what I discovered in doing business in Japan and then Asia Pacific is it takes a while to get through that armor, to get through that tatemai armor, to discover who that person is. And it works both ways. Like, I just can't show up and be, you know, a gregarious, overbearing Westerner, slapping backs and saying, hey, let's do business, right?
Yeah.
I need to be patient. I need to be a little bit more, say, reserved. I need to slowly show whoever I'm doing business with who Michael Veltri is, as they show me who they are. And what I've discovered is, you know, once you build that relationship and you're able to show each other, you know, more of your honmai, of your true self, those business relationships run really, really deep, you know, and it's amazing what you can accomplish. So another way of saying that is the Japanese are also really have their eye on the long-term view of a business relationship, not just looking two or three quarters down the road, but two or three decades down the road. Two or three years is nothing, you know, two or three decades. So it's really having a broad view, taking your time to build the relationship. And once it's there, it's a very successful lifelong relationship. But you can't go in and being impatient, thinking, you know, I'm going to be successful overnight. And you know, that's been my experience in working with Japan, both setting up Western companies there and showing them how to do business, and then myself doing business throughout all of Asia Pacific for the 10 years I lived there.
Yeah, and I absolutely agree with that. And to add on, there is I recently read a wonderful example of this, and it was a sushi chef, and he was a very sort of famous chef within the Tokyo area, and many considered to him to be the top guy when it comes to his job and his trade. And his relationship of trust within his suppliers was actually very amazing, because he would never ask what the price of a fish is. So they would not tell him, he would not ask. So he would buy out of trust, but at the same time, they would never give him something which is below his quality. They would never even try to, you know, get rid of some stock or just say, well, this will be good enough for him. So when I was watching him, it was a really interesting dynamic of a business relationship, which you don't often see in the West. And I found that quite fascinating.
Well, you know, in that example, and I'm familiar with that story, that's also, think of how his ki flowed. Like, right, like he was in his right vocation where his ki was so strong, not in an overbearing way, but that it built that trust, and that he knew, like, when was the last time either me or you, you know, buy anything and didn't ask about the price, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, how great is that to be in those types of harmonious relationships where, you know, it's sort of like a marriage, you know, you know what the other one's thinking, you know what they want or need, and you can trust and realize that the quality is going to be there, and that the supplier knows they're gonna be paid, and it's a great relationship. My goodness, how great would it be to have more of those in our lives?
Yeah, absolutely agreed. And actually, it leads into my next question. And it seems that confrontations and distractions seem to be kind of the two biggest issues we have to deal with at the workplace. Yes. And while distractions can often be things like emails and notifications, and we can sort of turn them off and we can play around with them, the people, not the things, are exactly the opposite. How can we possibly deal with them effectively?
Yeah, and you know what? The troublesome things called human beings, right?
Yes.
We all got to deal with them. This is a great question, you know, and I do deal with it a bit in the book. For all of your listeners, there's two things that I want to get across that can help them handle confrontation in the workplace or any type of confrontation, and it deals around communication skills. Now, of the communication, there's two specific skills that I want to talk about that will drastically impact how you handle confrontation in a harmonious win-win way, because it has to be win-win. Win-lose or lose-lose, you know, doesn't work. It has to be win-win. Now, say, let's just use the example of a coworker that's, you know, you're having trouble with. It could be a boss, it could be a subordinate, it could be a fellow manager, your same level, that's upset with you. Anytime you're dealing with confrontation, and this is true with the martial arts also, your non-verbal communication is exponentially more important than anything that comes out of your mouth verbally. So because of evolution, the way the human mind understands communication is that it will recognize, understand, and more importantly, trust your non-verbal communication over anything that you say verbally. So, non-verbal communication, body posture. If you're dealing with a confrontation at work, first and foremost, your body posture, your non-verbal cues are absolutely imperative. If someone is standing confronting you, you stand up straight, shoulders back, eye contact. Now, that's not an aggressive posture, right? But if you remain seated, if you slump your shoulders, if you avoid eye contact, all of those are cues for the other person to keep bullying you, because, you know, workplace bullying, you know, is a huge problem in today's corporate America.
Yeah.
So stand up straight, shoulders back, and eye contact. The other thing is, what do you do with your arms? Okay, if you cross your arms over your chest, if you grab your hands just sort of like crossed in front of your belly or abdomen, those are all defensive, weak postures. The arms can simply be open, palms out at your side, so your palms are facing towards the person down at your sides, sort of like an inverted V. Now, of course, right, you know, you stand there stiff as a board staring at the person. It's a relaxed posture.
Yeah.
But those nonverbal cues already are giving the person confronting you, letting you know that you're going to be firm and flexible, not a brick wall, right? Nobody wants to deal with a hard-headed brick wall, and you don't want to be a jellyfish, blah, you know, where person just takes advantage of you. But you want to have a backbone. Your backbone is firm and flexible. So that's the first thing, posture. Then the second thing is you have to use inclusive conversation. Remove you statements from your communication. You. It has to be I statements and inclusive. So, for example, something like, you know, I really want our project to succeed. I really want our company to be successful. I really want your team to be successful. That's okay when you can use the you statement. But the body language, inclusive I statements, and, you know, move a conversation forward. If, for example, it is not the right time to talk, right, you've got to be able to call a timeout. You got to say, hey, Tom, I really want our company to succeed. I really want our project to be successful. I really want, you know, our team to hit 200% of our sales quota. Things are a bit crazy right now. I'd like us to talk again, you know, today at 3 o'clock or tomorrow at 2 o'clock, right? Like, you've got to give positive opportunities for a person to say, we can't avoid our problem, like we talked about earlier, you know, in the interview here, we won't go away. But body language, first and foremost, and then second, inclusive communication skills will help handle conflict at work, right? There is no silver bullet. And like anything, it's a practice, right? The more you practice looking a person in the eye, the less uncomfortable you'll be. Some people are very uncomfortable making eye contact, but like anything, it's a practice. Practice it. The more you practice inclusive I statements, the better you'll get at it. So that's my advice for handling conflict in the workplace. You don't want to be a brick wall and just be inflexible and go nowhere. You don't want to be a jellyfish where you just sort of let yourself be taken advantage of, but be that flexible backbone that's firm and flexible. Body posture, inclusive conversation, try that. I guarantee you'll have much more better positive results in handling any type of confrontation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think by doing those things, you as well, you're reassuring the other person or people across who are maybe perhaps looking for some sort of assistance or comfort. And, you know, having that confidence is, I think, the best way to start off the conversation, because I think otherwise you might run the risk of kind of creating a problem for yourself without there really being one. I think it's just a natural human reaction.
Yeah, and again, it's sort of what you mentioned earlier too, right? That little monster in us gets scared, and that guy comes out.
Yeah.
And
why is this happening? What reason is it? You know, is this okay? Is that okay? Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And this leads into my last question today, and that is, what are you currently reading?
Oh yeah, so. Very important. Two things, and I actually recommend this as a peak performance tool in my book. Obviously, I'm a big fan of nonfiction. I love self-educating and reading things that interest me. But first and foremost, I recommend everyone, you know, dive into some good fiction. And especially studies have shown that reading as few as 6 minutes of fiction before going to bed helps your brain shut down and gets a higher quality of sleep. So I'm reading some type of fiction. You know, I like sort of Jason Bourne type thriller stories. Yeah. You know, that I was just watching, you know, I love Daniel Craig as James Bond. It's funny, I was just, you know, I dived back into some of the old James Bond. They're fantastic. So I've always got some fiction going on. And then as far as nonfiction, I started as a parent later in life. I'm 48 years old and I have a beautiful 3-year-old daughter. And so I have been reading many parenting books that have been, it's so great because many of the parenting books are a lot of what the business books are saying. You're just dealing with a 3-year-old versus a 33-year-old. So,
right.
I'm reading two books now one on raising my child and one in the business area. I've been reading this, and I recommend, whether you have kids or not, these books are fantastic. This woman, Barbara Coloroso, has written a book called Kids Are Worth It, and it basically talks about something what you said earlier, instilling responsibility in your children.
Yes.
Now, if you're a manager at work, you are faced with the same thing, whether you manage yourself or you manage one people or 1,000 people. How do you manage your team so that they are taking personal responsibility and making better decisions? So Barbara Coloroso, Kids Are Worth It. If you have kids or not, I encourage you to check it out. The other one I came across is a really cool book called Hacking Innovation by Josh Linkner. And in it, Josh is an entrepreneur, and he spent, I don't know, 18 months sort of shuffling around this underbelly of hackers and did research on how hackers are so innovative in, you know, coming up with the latest hacking techniques and in that ever-changing, shifting space of hacking. And he took it and took the principles he learned from exploring this hacker world and showing how we can become more creative and innovative in our business lives. And it's a fascinating book, even just for, you know, Josh's skullduggery in going around with hackers for a year to learn what's going on. I highly recommend it to your readers. I'm sorry, to your listeners.
And with that, I would like to thank you very much for joining us today. It's been an absolute pleasure having you, Michael.
Well, Well, thank you. The pleasure's been mine, and I really look happy I could contribute to your podcast.
And to those listening, of course, you can find out more about Michael and his work by visiting his website at www.michaelveltri.com. And you can also reach out to him on social media at Twitter at MPVeltri. And with that, I would like to thank you very much for joining us today, and we look forward to seeing you on the next episode of LID Radio.